Signed, Woodstead Ministry, Queensland. It's now Friday evening, the 5th of December 1986, and we're at the Right to Life dinner with guest speaker Dr. Peter Ravenscroft.
Dr. Peter Ravenscroft, our guest speaker for the night, when Christopher gets back to his seat and pays attention. Thank you very much. Without further ado, Dr. Peter Ravenscroft.
Please make yourself comfortable. If you can't see, turn your chairs around or do whatever you want to. Firstly, I better do what I'm told. That's what I thought. Faye and I'd like to thank you for this invitation to talk to you. I also bring you greetings from a group which I'm an active member of, and that's Christian Medical Fellowship, which comprises some 150 doctors in Queensland and their families who support the basic ideas that we're going to talk about tonight. And also another group which I'm very closely allied to, and that's the Labrie Fellowship, which was commenced by Francis Schaefer, who's also very much involved in the same sort of activity that you are. And I bring you greetings from the group in England and in Switzerland primarily, and also in the United States. I have regular contact with them, and you may know they come to Australia from time to time for conferences. Now, I've been asked to talk tonight about what I may consider a Christian approach to abortion. And so I would like to work through with you some of the ideas which I see that may be foundational in approaching the problem of the value of life, which has, of course, got great implications for the issue of abortion. And I do so saying to you that I understand that this matter brings forth a great deal of tension, not only amongst people who are Christians, but also those who are non-Christians. It brings forth very deep emotions, and it clashes in terms of our own very basic values of life. And we come in direct contrast to those who are humanists, those who sustain the idea of absolute rights for women and control of their own bodies, and to those, I think, where Australia is so readily characterised, and that is those who just have a laissez-faire attitude about life and who are prepared to do whatever makes them comfortable at any point in time. And I must say that of those three alternatives, I find them perfectly logical. If you begin with the presuppositions that humanism and rights for women and a laissez-faire attitude have, if you begin with those kinds of rights, then abortion is perfectly logical and reasonable, I would say. But I want to talk to you tonight about some other problems which we're in the midst of in medicine, and that is the problems of discussions of bioethics of life. And, of course, whenever we begin to talk about these, we don't range just through abortion, but we move to euthanasia and infanticide and mercy killing as well. And we can't really extract these alternatives, I don't think, out of our thinking. And at the moment, there's raging in the medical literature a tremendous controversy because the bioethicists that are coming to the fore today are trying to displace the traditional ethics from the ideas, particularly within doctors and medical professionals. Now, the primary approach in ethics has been, right from the days of Plato and his Greek colleagues, was to establish a consensus of principles by which life could be, if you like, evaluated, and then to look at the individual cases which challenge our values of life and compare them with those overall universal ideas, and be able then to come to a conclusion as to whether or not a certain way of approaching the problem should be pursued. And in the parlance today, you may have read that this is called the essentialist approach, because there is an essential, if you like, or an agreed or universal proposition. We might say that one such thing is that we don't condone killing. And then we would look at cases that involve the possible threat to life and evaluate them against that generally acceptable tenet and decide then whether we should pursue this matter. And in medical ethics, and I think in theological pursuits involving ethics, this sort of basic approach of establishing agreed universals and then considering cases has been the way the thinking has gone. But there has been a major revolution that is coming about and is being pursued with great vigour. And this is called the scientific population thinking. And it's based on an evolutionary premise in which the general and universal ideas of the value of life, which might be held by all people, are no longer valid. We see the population with whom we deal as a group of people who have evolutionary variability given to them by their genetic and environmental factors. And so we are able to look at these individuals and not through the universals first and consider these particular individuals and their problems. And this has great appeal in many ways because these people are focusing on individuals. And I'm sure you know better than I do that one of the great criticisms of those people who espouse the sanctity of life is the criticism that they do not consider the individual problems of the person involved at the particular point in time. And those bioethicists who are pushing this particular approach are trying to displace the overall agreed-to values which might govern an ethical evaluation. And what I'd like to do is to think about these two different conflicting ideas and to ask the question, how does a Christian approach come to grips with these sort of evaluations? And first of all, I think I need to consider what are the elements of a Christian approach to the issue of abortion? And I think that there are three. The first is that we need to consider the Christian presuppositions on which we would begin to argue. The second is that we have to deal with God's law as given to us in the Old Testament and reinforced in the New. And the third is that we have to consider the individual feeling by which we might come to someone in great trouble, and that is the compassion that we feel for those around us. And so I'd like to deal with those. The first is the Christian presupposition, and I was interested to hear that most of you are Christians, and so perhaps I won't go into quite as much detail as I thought. But let's just enumerate them fairly briefly. The first is that we begin with the Judeo-Christian proposition that God exists, and that he not only exists, but he has given us a propositional statement in Scripture which we can understand. That is, it is in language, it can be dissected, it can be understood in detail. And then also we live with the influence of the Holy Spirit amongst us as a guider and interpreter of that propositional statement of God. It means that we are not to act autonomously and evaluate life from our own basis with the own finiteness that we have in looking at things around us. But we, in spite of that, are to test for ourselves the truth of the propositions that God gives to us, so that we ourselves can have the conviction as to whether or not God's statements about life are true. And so that we live our lives, if you like, testing and proving God's word, so that we build up for ourselves our own personal history of the truth of his statements in the face of a very, very difficult and fallen world. Secondly, that we have to acknowledge that we are his creation, and that we are made in his image, as it says in Genesis 1. This gives us absolute value. This gives to humans absolute value. Value which cannot be detracted by physical disability or mental incompetence, and nor by the partiality of us in our own fallen, often jealous and selfish ways. And once someone has this value given by God, then it means that the taking of human life becomes one of the most precious things that the world has. As God pointed out to Noah in Genesis chapter 9. Now, thirdly, and very importantly, together with those two, we must understand the nature of the moral and physical corruption of the life that we live in, the environment that which we are in. This corruption comes to our existence from the fall, which is the historic interaction of God with man, which gives us, none of us, the option of living a perfect life. But all of us understand something of the physical and emotional disability of being imperfect. It also means that we carry this disability with us as we face the human dilemmas that we ourselves have, and also as others around us have, so that we cannot become absolute, but rather dependent on God for advice, and also clearly not judgmental in the sense that Jesus was so willing to point out to the Pharisees and others around about him. And so if we take those three points, we have, if you like, basic presuppositions which we can come to the issue of life and begin then to build upon it a framework of thinking. And the first that I want to mention in the set of ideas that we must take with us, to deal with God's law, the law of the Ten Commandments, and always remembering that apart from the direct statements that appear in Exodus 20, we have also the Sermon on the Mount, for instance, which reinforces the law, saying that we shall not commit murder. So that we are not looking at ancient statements of the law which are no longer relevant, but we are looking at Jesus' confirmation of this as well. Now, as far as I can understand, the statement of these laws, that we shall not kill, does not discriminate between the born and the unborn, but rather there is confirmation that God is the author of life and that all life intrinsically belongs to him, including fetal life. And we see those great statements of David in the Psalms and also of Job, where they had the overwhelming sense that God cared for them before they were born, and that he had a plan for their lives. Now, I do not see anything that contradicts the scriptural view that has been historically held over centuries by Christians and only in the recent decades seriously abandoned by a large proportion of the so-called Christian society, in inverted commas. Now, if we take these laws as given to us by God, what we have, in fact, is the Christian equivalent of the essentialist point in bioethics. That is, that we might start, and if we look at the law of Exodus and the Sermon on the Mount, we have universal principles, which in fact would lead us to say that the only appropriate position is an absolute anti-abortion position, and that to take any alternative line of action would in fact be to contravene God's law. And some people do that and hold this position very strongly. Now, I think there are some points that we should stop and evaluate with respect to this anti-abortion position. I think, firstly, we have to realise that the absolute anti-abortion position is one which is appealing to those people who find a basic and relatively clear statement something which they long for in their lives, and which they can hang on to in spite of the complexity of modern life. It also means that if you have such a universal law and are prepared to think no further about it, then you do not need to give the individual case, which may, for instance, be seeking, the individual person who may be seeking an abortion, any detailed evaluation, at least to make your decision. You simply say, my universal is that I shall not be involved in killing, and this is God's law, and therefore I will not think about this person's problem anymore in terms of that decision. The second situation is this, that of course those who take an absolute anti-abortion stand are frequently criticised for being insensitive And I think you've probably been criticised for that as well, being insensitive to the needs of individuals. Now, one of the problems with an absolute anti-abortion stand is that it's very hard to be totally and logically consistent. And we should ask ourselves how many of us would, in fact, refuse to interfere with a pregnancy which involved a threat to the mother's life. If we took an absolute and logical anti-abortion stand, we would not interfere with that pregnancy, and we would potentially leave both the baby and the mother to die. So that in the real world, it's very hard to be totally and logically consistent to an absolute anti-abortion position. We need to ask ourselves further, I think, what importance do the biblical statements about the nature of life have in our own ethical decisions? And the first point I would make is that the statements of the biblical law do not comprehensively represent the Christian position, although that it's important to understand that they represent God's absolute will. Can I say that again? It's a bit tortuous. The statements of the biblical law about thou shalt not kill, let's say, do not comprehensively represent the Christian position, although it is important to understand that they represent God's absolute will. We need to take notice, for instance, of Christ's interpretation of the biblical law. Now, Christ confirmed the continued validity of the law, but he pointed out that there was an extra dimension which had its origin in God's own personality. We find God's nature expressed both as holiness and grace, as justice and also mercy. That is, not absolute holiness nor absolute justice apart from grace and mercy. That we have these dualities in God's nature. In presenting this aspect of God's nature, we find Christ confronting the accusers of the woman taken in adultery with their own fallenness, and asking the person without sin to cast the first stone. That is, that he rejected the rigid application of the law. But he does not reject the validity of the law, because he told that woman to go away and to sin no more. Now, I know that this situation is not completely analogous to the problems associated with abortion, infanticide, and euthanasia. But I am personally compelled by Christ's own attitude to the application of the law and his condemnation of the Pharisees, and also God's own application of the law in the Old Testament, where there were the cities set aside for those who could flee for justice. There was David, who was allowed to pick grain that was normally reserved for the high priest and the priestly families. That is, that the law was never in itself seen within the Jewish context as being rigid, as being a tool of oppression. But rather, the law was seen within the Jewish context as being something that gave people great joy. It was like the plan of a maze. God's law showed them, as finite people living in a land that was full of horrors, how they might live, how they might establish values for each other, relate to the God who existed, and establish for them a community which would continue to have relationships with God and deep meaning on a person-to-person level. So this law was always treasured, and we see in the Psalms the delight in the law of the Lord. It was not an oppressive tool. It was a guide given by God for people who did not have, who did not have the infiniteness to be able to evaluate all that there was and establish for themselves absolute law. God gave it to them. Now, Christianity affirms the value of the individual, even though spoiled by evil. Christianity rejects people as part of a faceless crowd, as tools in the progress of humanity, but it rather follows Christ's example in seeing those he met as persons who would exist for eternity and worth dying for. So that Christianity can be seen to have a very compassionate face, a face which looks past the crowd to the very individual. And the very nature of the gospel itself is the individual response and understanding of who God is and of their own need for God to intervene in their life. And so there is a real sense of compassion which has to be balanced to make the total perspective of the law complete. But there is a problem that once we ease ourselves away from the rigidity of the law, its essential universal nature, we come to a situation where compassion can be used as the fulcrum which can favour all sorts of activities, including the killing of people, for individual compassionate, inverted commas, reasons. Those who are absolutely against abortion are often seen as tying themselves to these abstract ideas and laws, such as the ethical or religious principles, and being regardless of those in need. The need itself that these people have to perhaps have an abortion is often seen by others as a result of their gender, or as a result of adverse social circumstances which were not of their own making. And hence, why should they be victimised for circumstances which they have not created? And so we might ask ourselves, what is an appropriate degree of a compassion to have on such people? And we can see that there are boundary limits to this. On one hand, we could have so little compassion for the individual that we would apply arbitrary law. Thou shalt not kill. There shall be no abortion. Or on the other hand, we could have such great compassion for people, for their individual need, that so-called mercy killing, for example, would be allowed as a convenience, just on the basis of the expression of some compassion, of some difficulty. Now, in trying to balance these out, we need to avoid the extremes of inconsistent ethics, which, like inconsistent philosophy, is of no value to anyone. We need to begin with clear terminology and definitions. For instance, for my place, I'm forced by the biological facts to conclude that new life begins at the point of conception and not at some arbitrary point later on. I find that language casts an important bias on our thinking, and that we should take tremendous care not to allow the use of impersonal terms like products of conception for the fetus, to use terms such as life not worthy to be lived. And so we find ourselves slipping down the easy way of abandoning life without searching diligently for answers. And thirdly, we need to foster the arguments which do not allow early abortion on the basis that the early and poorly developed fetus is of little value or potential, because we have already seen that the in vitro fertilization program has shown that such early developed fetuses have tremendous potential and can develop into normal babies. And we have a society that on one hand is killing babies at the same stage in which, on the other hand, they're spending huge amounts of money to make sure that they grow and are implanted and become healthy fetuses. Such schizophrenic attitudes. We also need to understand that many of the cases towards abortion are often presented as biased cases, as what I call hard cases, exceptions, unusual cases, used, in fact, to justify thousands of other cases which don't qualify on the same basis. Here, these hypothetical cases are readily put by those who would debate the matter on television or in public forum. But, in fact, clinicians seldom see such patients. One of my friends, for instance, who is the head of obstetrics and gynaecology in one of Brisbane hospitals, has only seen a handful in all his experience in the last few years of these really hard cases. And so we should not be biased by inappropriate cases and difficulties, because in many cases the presentation of these unusual ones has paralysed many people into silence on the matter. And certainly this has been so amongst doctors. Now, how should we respond to such difficulty? I believe that, firstly, as a Christian, we must see the compassion as a very real need for us to have upon those who find themselves in difficulties. But this compassion must lie within the overwhelming framework of God's law and God's personality as it's revealed to us. And that all of this must work within a fallen world, where our judgments must be understood as incomplete and often biased. We should not, in fact, have free-floating compassion, which allows us to yield to virtually any request for abortion. And what worries me is that the scientific population thinking, this new form of ethics which is being propagated, has in fact no overriding framework. And I can hardly see how clinicians who are involved can avoid requests for abortion on demand when put as a compassionate plea to free them from some personal difficulty, whether it's the inconvenience of having a baby in an unmarried situation, the financial problems involved, or the nurture of one extra child in financial or large family situations. For us, the sanctity of life is primary, given by God, established within the law, and the basic framework under which we live. And yet we have to be sensitive, exceedingly sensitive, in the face of people who have the most terrible difficulties. I think no one's request for an abortion ought to be denied out of hand because of a preconceived principle alone. Nor should an abortion be agreed to without consideration of the God-given sanctity of life. There needs to be a very careful balance. When this balance is held, the question of abortion becomes the most serious and agonising decision, which should never be taken unless all the alternatives are exhaustively explored. Now, I find that given this proposition, that in fact the Christian concept of ethics, as I've outlined, is to me much better than the two, if you like, secular approaches of the essential method invoked by the Greeks because of its incomplete understanding and willingness to deal with the individual case problems. And on the other hand, the population thinking method, which has no overwhelming framework to appeal to. As Christians, we have both the framework of God's given law, but also the need to sensitively work with people and the ability to take decisions, even though these decisions may be terrible in their consequences. We need to emphasise the variability of individuals, their personal difficulties. We need to understand, as we deal with these problems, the imperfection of our own lives and the real possibility that our evaluation is incomplete because of our own personal approach. I think where abortion seems to be indicated on strict medical grounds, it ought to be seen as a tragedy and a death of a human, never to be minimised in any way. which means that there must be a real sense of loss to both the patient, the mother, and also the doctor. And too often the doctor is seen as an impersonal person in this relationship. That can never be. I think also in our approach, there needs to be support activities to go with the basic thinking that we have. That we need to teach something of the sanctity of life within our own family. That we live out such principles in the dealing with one another and with our children. That we need to be sensitive to the needs of sex education. We need, in fact, pregnancy advisory services, homes for pregnant mothers, as I know you provide, adoption services that are realistic and appropriate if we are not to find that in the practical sense the only real possibility when it's all worked out. Abortion. And then we need people like you, not only to put before the public and the politicians, but to make doctors aware that there is support in the community, particularly by those who, in a Christian sense, understand the sanctity of life. Because it can be very lonely, for doctors who stand against ready abortion, because they are not only unpopular with their patients, but they're unpopular with their colleagues in the hospital as well, and often derided and denigrated. And the presence of a voice within the community is enormously encouraging to those people. And I think that all of these things involve cost in time and money and emotions. And such cost is something I believe that God requires us to make as in our individual way, as we respond to the fact that we are not autonomous, but that he has made us and given us our own value, that we are made in his image. And so we owe him a debt, if you like, that we are valued not by others, but by him primarily. Thank you. I'd like to hear your questions and disagreements. I'm always wanting to change my own thinking. I think you do it already by the fact that you make your presence felt in the media and in situations such as outside the clinics that are involved in abortions. Well, I think it's hard perhaps to reach them collectively in a hospital situation. I think you do it in the ways I've suggested. I think in your personal contacts with doctors, it's important for them to be aware that you are a person who understands the sanctity of life and supports it strongly. And they are sensitive to that. Unfortunately, they have the experience of people coming along time and time again wanting abortions on demand for not very good reasons, and it's very hard to raise the courage to argue against this when you know that it's all going to be a big problem. But I think every person who indicates in their whatever way that you support this idea helps. Yes, I do. That's absolutely wrong. I mean, I don't think abortion's okay ever. What I'm saying is that there are some situations in the light of the horror of the family life, the maldevelopment of the fetus, the threat to the mother's life, or some such overwhelming problem where an abortion may have to be done. And in that situation, what I'm saying is that we are acknowledging that we are killing the baby and not minimising it. Let me ask you a question. What is your approach to a situation where a mother is likely to die when she is at term, but you know she'll live if she has an abortion? Would you let the mother and baby die, or would you abort? Yes. But you know that there's a problem in that, isn't there? There's a logical inconsistency in doing this, and we have to understand that it's true. Why should we sacrifice a baby for the mother? Why should we? Why not sacrifice the mother for the baby? How do we evaluate? Sure. Sure. Yes, that's right. And in fact, I would certainly honour that choice. But we have to realise that at the point that we make this choice, we are making a choice for abortion under adverse circumstances.
But somebody has to die. Somebody
has to die. That's right.
But apart from that, what are the possibilities?
Well, it's never okay. Can I get you to stop saying okay? It's the most terrible thing to kill a person. Well, I think that obviously you are involved in this sort of decision, and I have to admit to you that I don't take this decision anymore because I'm not an obstetrician and a gynecologist. But I think there are some situations where some of the people that I know, who are in a Christian sense much more dedicated and intrinsically wonderful Christians than I would ever be, are convinced by the horror of the circumstances that they have little option. But as I'm saying, we're talking about a minute number. Absolutely minute number. We're not talking about a lot. We're not talking about 1,000. We're talking about less than 1 a year in a huge hospital, perhaps. That's right. Yes. Yes. And what I'm saying is the point you make is right. I'm not talking about those. I don't see any place for abortion in that situation.
Okay, but my final point would be fine. Try and say that 60,000 children starting for this year, we shouldn't have the word cut out.
Yes.
We could say, at this point, we could accept from the other issue aside, couldn't we?
Sorry, we could accept?
Put the other issue aside.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. But can I just say to you that you're doing the same thing as the pro-abortionists do. What you're doing is selecting extreme cases to support a general argument. And I'd agree such a case is true. Some of the great geniuses of the world have been very ugly people physically and had all sorts of problems. So, yes, there are your individual cases that support leaving an apparently deformed baby go on to term and be delivered. And then there's the other few. But the problem is, the real worry is that we are seeing the killing of children that are normal and mothers who are asking for those babies to be killed on the grounds that I reduce down to convenience. that it's interfering with their life from one way or other. Yes. I mean, I think that the very important issue you raise of the very few individuals who, for medical reasons, need an abortion, are something that that it becomes a matter between the parents and the doctor before the Lord. And there's a sense in which I can tell you that some of my colleagues really feel as though they are murdering a human being and yet are left with no alternative. They don't minimise it. I mean, the real... Pardon? Well, because the medical consequences of the situation continuing are even far worse. Well, here we go. What I'm trying to say is, you see, you've set yourself up a universal that killing is your universal proposition, which shall not be done. And so you're saying nothing can be worse than violating that universal. Well, you see, that's an arbitrary exception that you're making because you feel it's a good thing. As far as the logic of it is to me. And you see, I would feel just as dreadful about having to kill the child in that situation.
It's more fundamental though, because in my experience, I'm relying then on the authority of the Christian Church to interpret God's law, and they say that it's okay, that you can have an abortion when you're not as well.
Oh, okay. Okay, now I understand what you're saying. You and I obviously come from a different strand of the Christian thing, and I accept what you're saying. I mean, if the church which you believe in has a very strong point to make here, and that you feel in all that sense that this is the rational way to go, well, then of course this may be perfectly reasonable. And my colleagues who have the same basic set of ideas would have to say to the patient, look, this is the way I believe the situation to be. And if you want to discuss it further, then you'll have to see, I'll see one of my colleagues who, although he's a Christian, sees things in a less defined way. And I would tell you that amongst us, Christians of goodwill, there is this difference of bias and belief. And we respect each other enormously. And I think there isn't any way around that. But I understand what you're saying, and I accept it. It's a real problem. But what I was saying really was that, to me, in my interpretation of the scripture, I see both the framework of the law together with this need of compassion to consider the individual problem in the face of a fallen and diseased and deformed situation that life sometimes brings. And it places us in a situation as medical people, of sometimes having to take a terrible decision which we would never want to take, but we are forced into by the fallenness of the world and the disease that we have to face. And that's a problem that we face.
You just sort of mentioned the idea of the law and being balanced with compassion.
Yes. Well, you raise a very good point. One of the things that we have to live with in the fallen world is the consequences of our own actions and beliefs. That is, that if you make a decision in this life to completely turn away from the Lord, then there are consequences to that in your own life and in your life in the unseen world to come. Now, for the Old Testament people, if you believe the scriptural account the way it is, one presumes that those people had the opportunity of deciding whether or not they were going to follow along the way of those people who recognised that God exists or turned away from him. And as Paul says in Romans 1, all people have the obligation to in fact evaluate the fact that the creation exists and that God's power is evident in our own existence. And if we decide to deny that, then we turn our thoughts towards futility and we bear the consequences of it. And unfortunately, it seems to me that those people in the Old Testament who in fact came against the wrath of God's people were suffering from the situation that there were consequences to them turning away from God. And that there was a need, although it seems so terrible to us, that war had to be made, that the nation of Israel had to survive against the odds. And so there had to be murders and slain. And it's a very difficult question, but I think in the totality of understanding, the consequences of sin is death. It's the most terrible thing to contemplate, but it's true. And so in a sense, in our own lives, we don't escape from the consequences of our own belief and action. Now, I don't know whether that answers what you're saying in a specific sense, but I don't see that particular example as relating directly to the issue of abortion. I mean, I think it relates more to killing in the sense of whether we should go to war. Yes, I think I see what you mean. I mean, I would say that, first of all, that when someone decides that they want to have an abortion and do, then they will be accountable for that decision in the Lord's presence, in that they have made a decision which has led to the death of someone. But what I see is a Lord who understands the compassion of the circumstances of the fallen world. And sometimes where the decision has to be made, there can be forgiveness. There can be forgiveness for the ultimate crime that we ourselves are deliberately purveying, often day by day, in turning away from the Lord himself. And yet he gives us forgiveness and so on. And in a sense, if you break the law in one part, you've broken it in the totality. That's what Paul was on about. You know, don't try to sort things out in a legal sense, because you've only got to break the law once and you've had it. So I see that God is a wonderful God of compassion. And there will be situations perhaps where in the most terrible circumstances perhaps an abortion has been done. But I do believe that God will take into account the total circumstances and that there will be judgment which is righteous judgment, not the sort of judgment we get from one another in the biased and selfish sense, but true righteous judgment. And I think that's why it's so hard for us to determine what God's judgment will be. So infrequently do we know the thoughts and background of the people who come to us in such dreadful circumstances. It's very hard. Yes and no. How's that? I think that it is impossible to make a total blanket answer to that. If you look at the studies from various places on the responsiveness to people who've had abortions, some people have the most terrible consequences in depressive illness and so on, in remorse. And it's clear that some people have no such feelings at all. And I think it's important for us who've been brought up with particular attitude to life not to project that onto other people who may have been brought up in a situation where life seems to have very little value. We would wish that everyone would feel sensitive towards life, but they don't always do. How can you kill your grandmother? Wouldn't that worry you? People are suggesting we should do it. Even to the extent that they're an economic burden on society. Cut the taxes. Oh, it's not a matter of being accepted, but it's thought about and argued in subtle ways all the time as treatment is being thought about and the options for treatment to be continued or ceased or whatever. Yes, of course it is. I don't see things as God sees them, so I can't give you that answer. I think that everyone in the health professional group is entitled to act in their on their own conscience and to express it clearly. However, the circumstances of a cardiac arrest or some such emergency are such that action has to be taken to resuscitate the person or they'll die while we all think about the pros and cons. However, I should tell you that it's my experience that in the hospitals that I've worked on, very often too many people are resuscitated rather than too few. In other words, hospitals are generally at the moment, but not always, geared towards saving lives. And that's the terrible thing about euthanasia and mercy killing, that once the hospital is geared to killing people, the whole business of resuscitation and attention to detail in the care of those who are suffering is likely to suffer tremendously because they'll say, well, you know, why should I continue? We're going to why don't we terminate this life? At the moment, that's not considered as a major option in the situations that I understand. It's very hard for a nurse sometimes. Doctors have to take the decision about resuscitation based on often complex medical problems, and the nurse usually has to get on with it until the decision's made. Yes. Well, the problem of ordering drugs such as morphine is a problem that belongs to the medical person. A nurse is required to administer the drug, a nurse, whether it's the particular nurse or some other nurse, is required to do that. If there were no such discipline in a hospital, patients would be not getting drugs all day long. There'd be a complete fiasco. So if the drug's ordered, it ought to be given. A nurse, though, of course, may decide that that's a real problem for her. And she may talk to her superior and say that in the light of my own personal belief and the situation, I feel I can't do it. And good charge nurses will understand that. Sorry, this question's not related to anything that's gone before, has it? Euthanasia? What do you mean? Perhaps if you just clarify the question, I'll understand. Yes. Yes. As a generalisation, it's not correct, no. But you have to realise this. When you're using painkilling medication for cancer pain, it's very necessary that the doses be given regularly and not intermittently, with long periods between one dose and another. Otherwise, what happens is the pain breaks through and becomes very severe if you leave it a long time between doses. And then it's very hard to suppress. Oh, usually not. That's right. I mean, it's very unusual if someone's comfortably sleeping for anyone to be woken. I'm trying to get the motivation behind your question, and I think what you're saying is that if someone isn't woken and given the medication, then someone's trying to kill them. Is that what you're saying? Oh, I understand the question. Well, that may be so, if it's done that way. Yes. Yes.
The man gave him, he had cancer, but he wanted to die.
Yes.
He turned to suicide. This is one way. The doctors were very good at that they helped him die. And the order was to break the streets. Then he's on his treatment sheet. The man must have been awake and he wanted to sleep. He was given this large dose of morphine. What I did object to this.
This was oral morphine, was it? Mixture? When you wouldn't give the morphine, did you notify the doctor that you weren't going to do it?
Oh, yes.
And what did the doctor say?
I notified the night supervisor as well. We notified the general mate when he was suspended.
That's before the doctor was involved?
Before the doctor. No, the doctor was there. And the doctor was on duty. The specialist was calling. He insisted the morphine be given. He tried, and I don't give it. I'm not helping you. Tell the man, push him out of the presence. If he's going to die, he's going to die. And you can keep him free, as free of pain as possible. But I refused to tell him to commit suicide or murder. And, of course, the case went on for 3 weeks in the hospital. The union said that I did belong to two unions, the RDRA and the hospital employees. And I walked off with my job back in 3 weeks. And the man, when I came back to work, he was still alive. He did die of a terrible death. He was asleep in his strength before anything, so he died of renal failure rather than his cancer, because the morphine was still being accustomed to him today.
Yes. Well, I understand the situation. One of the ways around that is that I normally meet with all the nursing staff both day and night once a week so that I can talk to them about what I'm doing. It's at that situation that any nurses that object to what's being done ought to voice their objections and so that we can discuss the whole thing at that time. That's very important because not giving injections and so on, as you see, causes all sorts of difficulties if it's out of hours. But there is a great need for communication between the people who make up the team that are caring for patients. But it sounds as though you had as much trouble with the nursing staff, the senior nursing staff, as the medical staff. Yes, that's about the way it goes. Has anyone else got any questions? Yeah. No, it's never been true. Doctors in Queensland have never taken the Hippocratic Oath. I have a copy of the Hippocratic Oath, but it was given to me when I graduated, but I actually never took the oath. I wouldn't be likely to take the oath in the way it's put. It's really not a Christian document, as you imagine. Hippocrates wasn't a Christian. There are some very interesting new oaths, in inverted commas, which are being developed, particularly in the medical schools of the United States, where the students themselves, the graduating students, have decided that they would like to formulate something which represents the basics of good practice. And I've just seen one fairly recently in one of the medical journals. And so that's true. But the Hippocratic Oath, I don't know who takes the Hippocratic Oath. I've asked physicians in the United States and in England and in Europe, and I can't yet find anyone who's taken the Hippocratic Oath. It's in a sense a very good statement of what a physician should be. I mean, it talks about helping people and doing no harm. It talks about going to their houses and treating them with respect, understanding their individual natures. It talks about teaching medicine to those who are coming on in a willing way rather than keeping your knowledge to yourself and so on. It's a very professional statement, and considering it came out of about, 600 BC or something, it's a very sensitive document. So it's no wonder people do talk about it. I don't know anyone who's taken it.
Finally, what's your opinion of the best way to go about reducing or preventing abortion?
Reducing abortion? Yeah, I do. I'm not sure if you'd like it. It's to present the fundamental understanding of what Christianity is to the whole.